Good morning. Thanks, Greg, for the opportunity to give this presentation for the first time. We've developed it in collaboration with Susan Chilton and Sid Nathans and the Bicentennial Commission, the Lincoln Bicentennial Commission, and the Our Courts program. We intend to have this presentation available for all kinds of audiences, school audiences and adult audiences, through Our Courts and through the Bicentennial Commission and through whatever referrals you can make. I won't be the only speaker. We've set it up so that we'll have many different speakers, but fundamentally the presentation will be the same. Abraham Lincoln, as we all know, was born on February 12th. What we may not remember or know is that it was in 1809, and so 2009 is the 200th anniversary of his birth. And we owe an incalculable debt of gratitude to our founders, as we know, but we also owe such a debt to Lincoln to fulfill some of the principles that our founders established. Lincoln was committed to equality and to the Declaration of Independence, and today I want to talk about his dedication to liberty and the Declaration of Independence. The way I'm going to do it is we're going to use Lincoln's words, and we're going to use the words of people who knew him so that we can kind of go back in time and get a sense of Lincoln and how he was viewed at that time. So first, who was it that became president, our 16th president? Now I'm going to refer to him as Lincoln because that's the way he preferred to be referred to. One man who knew him well said, "I never knew anyone who addressed him as Abe. Lincoln disdained ceremony, and he gave no license for being called Abe. His preference was being called Lincoln, with no handle at all. We spoke of him as Uncle Abe, but to his face, we called him Lincoln." This suited him very well. He very much disliked to be called Mr. President, and this I knew, and I never once called him that. He didn't even like Mr. He preferred plain Abe. Now, as we all can remember, Lincoln was unique in his appearance. One biographer wrote that at age 19, Lincoln's weight was never quite proportionate to his height. He had long arms and large hands and a relatively small development of his chest, and he had strange deep-cut lineaments in his face. But his muscular strength was great, and there are startling statistics that are told of the weight that he could lift and the force of his blows with a mallet or with an axe. A friend who knew him in Illinois said that trials of strength were very common among the pioneers. Lifting weights as heavy as timbers piled one upon another was a favorite pastime, and no workman in the neighborhood could at all cope with Mr. Lincoln in this regard. I have seen him frequently take a barrel of whiskey by the chimes, lift it up to his face as if to drink out of the bunghole. This feat he could accomplish with the greatest of ease, but I never saw him taste or drink a drop of any kind of spirituous liquors. And in fact, Lincoln did not drink alcoholic beverages. Now, although Lincoln had a limited formal education, never attended law school, he had a very successful law practice. He was viewed as scrupulously honest and one of the best jury lawyers in Illinois. And yet, his appearance maybe didn't match what we might expect of an attorney. One colleague wrote, "He probably has had as little taste about dress and attire as anybody that ever was born. His trousers were always too short, and his hat was faded. He carried under his arm a worn green umbrella that lacked a knob and was tied with a string. Yet his courtroom manner, according to his law partner William Herndon, when Lincoln rose to speak to the jury or to crowds of people, he stood inclined forward, he was awkward and angular, he was ungainly and odd, and being a very sensitive man, his voice when he first began, speaking, was shrill, squeaking, piping, unpleasant. Lincoln's demeanor was cool, careful, earnest, sincere, truthful, fair, self-possessed, not insulting, not dictatorial. He was pleasing and good-natured. He was clear in his ideas, simple in his words, strong, terse, and demonstrative. He used in his gestures his right hand, sometimes shooting out that long bony finger of his to dot an idea or to express a thought. As Lincoln proceeded further along with his oration, so said his partner, his shrill, squeaking, piping voice became harmonious, melodious, musical, and if you please, with face somewhat aglow. He rose up in splendid form, erect, straight, and dignified. And in an image of Lincoln that we've all probably seen, his law partner William Herndon said, he frequently took hold with his left hand, with his left thumb erect, of the left lapel of his coat, keeping his right hand free to gesture in order to drive home a point to clinch an idea. Now, despite a melancholy that stayed with him throughout his life, his ability to tell jokes and funny stories was very well known. About himself, he said, others have been made fools of by the girls, but this can never of truth be said of me. I'm most emphatically, in this instance, made a fool of myself. When Stephen Douglas said that Lincoln was two-faced, Lincoln responded, I leave it to my audience. If I had another face to wear, do you think I would wear this one? And then, when he was to leave Springfield by train to go to Washington to be sworn in as president, someone asked him how it felt. And he responded, I feel like the man who was tarred and feathered and ridden out of town on a rail. To the man who asked him how he felt, he said, if it wasn't for the honor of the thing, I'd just as soon walk. So Lincoln arrived in Washington in 1861 to be sworn in as the 16th president. And as we all know, although the United States had existed at that time for 70 years, and that the 13 states had grown to 34 states, it was being broken apart by the secession of 7 southern states. And Lincoln's entire term as president, and indeed the entirety of the rest of his life, was consumed with the war, the Civil War, and the fight to preserve the nation. The war resulted in more than 600,000 casualties by death or disease, more than any war in our nation's history. And of course, the issue that was dividing the country was slavery. The Constitution permitted slavery. The Constitution didn't use the word slave, didn't use the word slavery. The Constitution referred to persons who might be imported. It referred to persons held in service to labor. The Constitution didn't refer to slaveholders. It referred to parties to whom such service or labor may be due. In addition, under the Constitution, a slave who escaped to a state that prohibited slavery had to be returned to his or her master. But beginning in 1820 with the Missouri Compromise, slavery was outlawed in more than 1 million square miles west of the Mississippi, from Minnesota to Montana along the Canadian border, and then south through Kansas, taking up, including most of Wyoming and much of Colorado. Lincoln began his fight against slavery before he became president. He began in 1854 when Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas introduced the Kansas-Nebraska Bill. And the point of the Kansas-Nebraska Bill was to permit slavery, to permit the territories to vote, to have popular sovereignty to decide if they would be free or slave states when they entered the Union. And this repealed the Missouri Compromise. Lincoln could not tolerate this, and decided at that time to run against Senator Douglas for the United States Senate seat. In October of 1854, in Peoria, Illinois, in a speech in reply to Douglas, Lincoln said, "I cannot but hate slavery. I hate it because of the monstrous injustice of slavery itself. I hate it especially because it forces so many good men among ourselves into an open war with the very fundamental principles of civil liberty. Criticizing the Declaration of Independence and insisting there is no right principle of action other than self-interest." Lincoln commented on the Constitution's avoidance of the word slave and slavery. He said that the Founding Fathers had kept slavery hidden in the Constitution. In Lincoln's words, "just as an afflicted man hides away a cancer, which he dares not to cut out at once, lest he bleed to death." Lincoln believed the Constitution's acceptance of slavery and was contrary to the famous principles of the Declaration of Independence. "We hold these truths self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are the rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Now, before Lincoln heralded the Declaration of Independence, the Declaration was seen as a historic document. It did not have the status of the Constitution. It didn't have the status of a statute or even an ordinance. The principles upon which it was declared, the equality of men, the liberty of people, did not have the force of law. It was simply the declaration of the separation from Great Britain. It was the announcement of the Revolutionary War, or was the start of the Revolutionary War. The Constitution was the document that established the law that pertained to the government and to the citizens. And as I've already said, the Constitution denied equality and liberty to the slaves. Yet, at the beginning of his presidency, even Lincoln was respectful of the Constitution itself. He noted that the founders had agreed and that the states had ratified the Constitution, and that as president, he was sworn to uphold it. But for Lincoln, the Declaration of the Independence was the moral foundation of our country. Lincoln said, and he said this at Independence Hall in Philadelphia, "I have never had a feeling politically that did not spring from the sentiments embodied in the Declaration of Independence. I have often inquired of myself what great principle or idea it was that kept the colonies together for so long. It was not the mere separation of the colonies from the motherland. It was the sentiment in the Declaration of Independence, which gave liberty not only to the people of this country, but I hope to the world for all future time. It was that which gave promise that in due time, the weight of oppression would be lifted from the shoulders of all men." Lincoln emphasized that the Declaration pertained to all men. "I think the authors intended to include all men," he said. "This they said, and this they meant. They meant to set up a standard maxim for free society, augmenting the happiness and value of life to all people of all colors everywhere." In Lincoln's view, the Declaration was to be a battlement against tyranny. He said, "We all declare for liberty, but in using the same word, we do not all mean the same thing. With some, the word liberty may mean for each man to do as he pleases for himself and the product of his labor. While others, for others, the same word may mean that some men may do as they please with other men and with the labors of other men. So here are two," he said, "not only different but incompatible things, called by the same name, liberty. But it follows that each of these things, called such by the respective parties, are incompatible. This is liberty and tyranny." Lincoln didn't practice any particular religion, yet he once said that the battle of freedom is to be fought out on principle. Slavery is a violation of eternal right. We have temporized with it from the necessities of our condition. But as sure as God reigns and the school children read that black foul lie can never be consecrated into God's hot hallowed truth. And so these were the views that Lincoln brought with him to the presidency. Now, as I said, he was acutely aware that the Constitution permitted slavery and that he was sworn to uphold the Constitution. In August of 1862, in a letter to Horace Greeley, he said, "My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union, and is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could do it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that." Yet, earlier that summer, Lincoln, because he was committed to his oath, had begun to talk with his cabinet and to explore the possibility of freeing the slaves. But he knew that as president, he did not have the power to be contrary to the Constitution. But he concluded that as to the loyal states, the Constitution still applied. But as to the rebelling states, they had withdrawn from the Constitution, and Lincoln, as commander-in-chief in occupied territory, could establish the law there. And so he decided that he would free the slaves in the rebelling states, and yet at the same time tell the loyal states that they could retain slavery or they could abolish it slowly or immediately. Now, he also considered what would become of the freed slaves. He spoke, as others did, about creating a separate colony of freed slaves. He decided that the proclamation of emancipation should support efforts to colonize African Americans with their consent in North America or South America. He met with African American leaders, including Frederick Douglass, to discuss how a colony might be established in South America. He also believed that when he freed the slaves, there would be a certain military advantage, but he did not want to announce the freeing of the slaves while the southern rebelling states were prevailing in the war. And so what he decided to do was to wait until there was an opportunity of strength, a victory of the Union forces, to announce his intention to free the slaves. And so it was in the fall, it was in September, when the Battle of Antietam was clearly to be won, that Lincoln decided to announce that as of January 1st, 1863, the slaves in the rebelling states would be freed. And so on January 1st in 1863, the Emancipation Proclamation was issued, freeing those slaves in the rebelling states. It also said that all able-bodied former slaves who wanted to join the Union forces would be free to do so, and some 180,000 of the freed slaves did so. He also said that they would be, He said that they would be accepted into garrison duty in the various installations. So this is January of 1863. We go now to autumn of 1863, and if you remember, that was when Lincoln made the famous Gettysburg Address. And once again, the words in the Gettysburg Address harken back to the Declaration of Independence. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. 2 years later, in 1865, near the end of his first term as president, in 1864, he was reelected. He was awaiting an inauguration for his second term. And the Congress of the United States proposed the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which would free the slaves. About 10 weeks later, General Lee surrendered at Appomattox Courthouse. And at that point, Lincoln knew that the war would soon be won, that the union would be preserved, and had confidence that the 13th Amendment would prevail and free the slaves. Those who knew him said that it appeared to them that this gave him peace and hope. In an impromptu speech that week after the surrender of Lee from the White House balcony, he said for the first time that he endorsed the idea of giving the vote to the freed slaves and to other worthy, intelligent black men. John Wilkes Booth was in the audience. John Wilkes Booth said that will be the last speech he ever makes. Just 5 days later, on Good Friday, April 14, 1865, Booth shot Lincoln, and he died early the next morning. But Lincoln's legacy continued. 8 months later, after his death in December 1865, slavery was forever abolished in the United States upon the ratification of the 13th Amendment by the requisite number of states. The following year, in June 1866, the 14th Amendment was proposed. That prohibited any state from depriving any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. It guaranteed all persons equal protection of the laws, and it was ratified 2 years later. This is the amendment that more than any other has enabled the civil rights to be fostered and to spread throughout the country. This is the amendment upon which the Declaration of Independence was made applicable to the state laws. In 1869, the 15th Amendment guaranteed the right to vote regardless of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. And it was proposed in 1869, and it was ratified in 1870. And so what had not been achieved in 73 years of constitutional government before Lincoln's presidency was achieved within 5 years after his death. And so as we commemorate the 200th anniversary of his birth, let's not forget that our country was, as he said, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. And that so long as slavery existed in the United States, these principles could never become a reality. It was Lincoln who navigated our country's course to take the step that was absolutely essential to enable these principles to become reality. Frederick Douglass, the great American leader, African-American leader, knew Lincoln's views about slavery and race, and he had been critical of Lincoln during Lincoln's life. Yet, after Lincoln's death, he said, "Lincoln began by playing Pharaoh, but ended by playing Moses." We all know that ending slavery did not end racism. It did not give women the right to vote. But it was Lincoln who took our country through the crucial step to fulfill the principles of the Declaration of Independence. And as a result, we, not only in the United States, honor him, but he is honored throughout the world as one of the great leaders of history. And so it's with considerable gratitude to Abraham Lincoln that we can proclaim our shared and unique American value that all men are created equal and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Well, Russ, congratulations. That is terrific. And so now I wanted to sort of relive the kind of the atmosphere at DU. I'm going to start with Susan, and then we'll go to Sid. Sort of a response. Has Russ got it? What has he missed? What was a larger frame? What was the minute detail that you would add, Susan?
Okay, well, thank you. Well, I would just say a couple things briefly. One, for me, studying Lincoln, the brilliance is not, as we so often think about Lincoln, as this icon, a distant leader that no one can touch. For me, as I've studied Lincoln over the last several years, the brilliance comes in the evolution over time. That is to say, as Russ alluded to, this is a man who was reared, as many of you know, as a Whig, and whose worshiped really the Constitution, not the Declaration of Independence. The problem comes when the West is open to slavery, when he realizes and he confronts this terrible possibility that the Constitution might actually endorse slavery, that he might actually be wrong. And so he's forced to come to grips with the possibility that the document that he has worshipped actually confirms inequality or confirms slavery. And so he goes back to figure out how he can find another conclusion. And that's what brings him to the Declaration. So for me, what's really compelling is to watch a man sort of come to terms with what the U.S. means, what the Union actually means. And to do that, he actually has to go back of the Constitution to the Declaration. And for him, the Declaration is the document that will give the Constitution meaning. The Constitution is devoid of any moral principle, right? It will become the vehicle by which we can implement the moral principles that we find in the Declaration of Independence. So for him, those two things are inextricable. But he didn't always think that. It was an evolution over time. The other thing I think is sort of brilliant about Lincoln is, as you mentioned several times, in the Gettysburg Address, and this is a sort of sleight of hand, as Gary Wills puts it, that we don't even notice because it's so self-evident to us. But he calls it a proposition. A proposition is something that you're working towards. So in the Gettysburg Address, he's done this thing by taking the founders and saying, they had these principles, but the unfinished business is what we have to do. So he sort of puts the ideal of the United States, the ideal of equality, not in 1776, because it wasn't achieved, right? But he says that's achieved in the future, and we're the ones that are going to fight for it, which allows him to say, to argue against all those that said, like Stephen Douglas, the nation was perfect at its founding, right? And that equality meant, of course, equality among men, and of course, among property-owning white men. So for me, those are two things that the brilliance of Lincoln is sort of in the evolution and also in the way he sort of comes to this idea over time, that it's not something that he sort of born.
Sid, come on up here. Sid Nathans, who's on the Bicentennial Commission, along with Susan, right? Susan, you're also on the commission.
I am.
Sid, your response.
So I think Russ has got it. I'm actually impressed by the way that Lincoln struggles to reconcile his role as the President of the United States and as the preserver of the Union and his moving toward making equality and emancipation the centerpiece of his administration. That, I think, probably doesn't come through, and that's okay. I think, you know, this is something he really grapples with and tries to figure this out. And as I say, I think that's all right that it doesn't come through. That's something that I would myself emphasize. Lincoln is the kind of man who's wrestling through these things. And he does that in the 1850s. He continues to do that.
And
the other element of Lincoln is once Lincoln decides, it's decided. People, right up to the moment of emancipation, black people in particular, are worried that he's not going to follow through on this. And there are a lot of people who say that he shouldn't follow through with this. One of the things he's worried about is, what are white soldiers going to do? Are they just going to drop their arms? They're not in it, for the most part, for emancipation. They're in it to preserve the Union. And Lincoln, and even there's a myth, I'm not quite sure whether it's reality or myth, that watch night, which is the way in which African Americans observe New Year's Eve. I've been there, black churches, waiting for New Year's Eve to come, waiting for January 1st, actually goes back to the time of January 1st, 1863, when they're watching and waiting to see if emancipation will actually come through. Watch that. Not waiting for the new year, waiting for the Emancipation Proclamation. And they do wait. And they actually have to wait most of the day, because when the original Emancipation Proclamation comes to Lincoln's attention and to his desk, brought by Secretary Seward in the morning of January 1st, 1863, there's a technical error there. And as we know in this room, technical errors won't do for an Emancipation Proclamation or any other judicial declaration. So Lincoln has to send it back and get it redone. And in the meantime, as many of you know, he has the usual reception for people at the White House on New Year's Day. And by the time he comes ready to sign the Declaration, the Emancipation Proclamation, his hand is shaking, and he realizes that won't do, so he just composes himself and then very firmly writes out his name. Well, all of this is to emphasize the way in which there was suspense right to the end, and then the same was true of black soldiers. And Lincoln said, you know, once I've decided, I'm sticking by it. I'm coming through it. So that's, I think, all part of it, working his way up to it and then deciding, this is it, you know? And from this point on, there is no turning back. I'm not turning back, and so forth. So I think all that is probably more than needs to be conveyed, but, you know, it is part of the story to me. I also think you do a nice job in conveying the Lincoln the man. It's 19th century language, but it conveys it. I myself am, as you can just tell by watching me, slightly more theatrical person, 4 years in the classroom to do that. You can kind of get bored with yourself after a while. So I'm into bodily gestures, which I think would indicate something of, which you did, you know, with the lapel and the, you know, indicate something of the angularity of the man, of the things that people found awkward about him. But I think that's important to convey right at the beginning, as you do so well, in order to humanize him from the outset. And then you move on to the way in which he shifts to moving the Declaration of Independence into the stature of law, basically of practice, then of law, and then finally the constitutional amendments. And I like the way that you just emphasized that the constitutional amendments come really 1, 2, 3, after a long period in which there are no constitutional amendments. And this is truly both Lincoln's work and Lincoln's death. The state of New York was not prepared to pass, to ratify the constitutional amendment. Most northern states did not allow black votes and restricted black citizenship. It tried to keep black people out, including Illinois. Certainly Wisconsin. God knows what would have happened. Not Colorado, actually. And Lincoln's death, New York legislature said, well, he's died. You know, that's it. We got to ratify it. We can't stop it now. So in a way, his life and his death set the stage for these amendments.
So. Okay, what was the technical flaw with the draft?
You know, I've never been able to find that out. I don't know what it was. In every book, I haven't read Burlingame's 2,000-page book. He's probably got it in there. But the other book's typo.
Well, Susan, Dred Scott. Dred Scott has the opinion of the Supreme Court has a very different view about the Declaration of Independence than Lincoln had. Would you speak to that?
Well, I'm a little nervous speaking to lawyers about Dred Scott, of course, but as you know, Dred Scott...
Didn't the judges get it wrong?
I'll let you decide. The way I teach it, it is known as the worst decision the Supreme Court has made in its history. So, Dred Scott is a decision, as you know, that comes down in 1857, where Chief Justice Taney, who is a Southerner and a slaveholder, leads the court in a majority opinion that decides that... slaves are property, and as property, they cannot be disallowed from any Western territory. That is to say, Congress cannot prevent the introduction of property, slaves, into any of the territories, so that the Missouri Compromise never could have disallowed slavery, and that the Kansas-Nebraska Bill actually is null and void as well, that you can allow slavery in your territory, but you can't decide not to have slavery. So you can see why this is perhaps not just the worst decision. It's predicated on the idea, of course, that slaves, that African Americans, because they were brought to this country as slaves, can never be citizens, correct? That's the fundamental principle. So it serves two parts. One, Congress cannot disallow property from the West, from the territories, and two, African Americans can never be citizens in this country. And I was reading a little bit of it, reminding myself as Russ was speaking, and it is chilling to read the language, to see the justices, particularly Taney or Taney, contort themselves to decide that the founders would have never wanted this present state of affairs. Now, it's an awkward thing for Lincoln because, of course, the Dred Scott decision effectively makes the entire Republican Party illegal, right? The Republican Party is founded in 1856. 54.
John C. Fremont being the first candidate.
Right, 56. The whole premise of the Republican Party is that the West will be free of slavery, and Mormonism as well, but that's a different story. And so the Dred Scott decision effectively makes it an illegal party, and this is, of course, a supreme problem for the Republicans, but especially for Lincoln. And that gives him all the more drive. And he uses it as a cudgel against Douglas, who had proposed this idea that Westerners could actually decide in the territories. Well, after the Dred Scott decision, of course, Stephen Douglas looks like a fool right? Because his principle of popular sovereignty is null and void. It cannot go forward. And so essentially, it raises several interesting issues, one of which is that by the time Lincoln becomes president, his concept of emancipation, his concept of slavery being free for the West is all fundamentally at odds with the Supreme Court. And you have open war between the President of the United States and the Chief Justice. And this comes up when, of course, Tommy says that he can't suspend habeas corpus and Lincoln ignores him. But we have essentially open chaos as to what the law of the West really is at the time of his inauguration.
Seth, you want to add to what Dred Scott?
Well, to me, this came up in an oblique way at a teacher's workshop that I was at, when a woman who was a teacher was explaining, you know, Lincoln's very interesting, but my class is 87% Hispanic. So what kind of connection do I make? So I suggested that, what if the Supreme Court of the United States, the current one, ruled that illegal immigrants and their children have no rights, that natural-born Americans need to respect? Could happen. How would you deal with that? And I said, look over Lincoln's shoulder. The Supreme Court ruled that blacks had no rights, that white people needed to respect. He had to deal with that. So you can watch him deal with that politically. You can watch him deal with that constitutionally. So, you know, say the Supreme Court has made an erroneous decision, but, you know, now we have to figure out ways to get it reversed. And, of course, he got himself elected president. But, you know, it's not irrelevant, you know, to look at Lincoln and then to ask, well, how would we deal with that? A decision that we consider to be fundamentally wrong, and yet it's the law of the land. So it seems to me that this is a way in which you can take that decision, make it quite relevant to our own time, it's not implausible, and then say, go back to the history books and say, how did he deal with it, and how the hell would we?
So I've given you excerpts from the opinion. Actually, it's the 1856 term. You're right, Susan. It was handed down in 1857, so that probably ought to be corrected.
Right after the election.
Right. But when you read it, I mean, Lincoln and the court are fundamentally at odds, as you said, because the proposition is laid out in a neat historical argument here. I like your comment on this about the way they use history. Since the blacks were inferior, they're always going to be inferior, and it couldn't have been that the framers of the Declaration really meant all men are created equal, right? White men are created equal to govern. Black people are not. We also know that there are problems with Native Americans that around the same time about how they're going to be treated. So let me give it back to you, Susan. This idea that property prevails, that the founders never could have considered black people as men that were created equal. So this proposition you talked about that Lincoln advanced, what is the brilliance of that, and is this bogus history that the Supreme Court uses here, and are judges competent to use this history like this?
Well, I think the problem is that if you put yourself back in 1857, if you looked at the history of the country, the Supreme Court's got it right. That is to say, it's Lincoln who's in the minority, right? It's Lincoln who's got to sort of say, well, the founders meant something very different. And he goes back after Dred Scott and, you know, locks himself up in the archives, immerses himself in the readings and writings of the founders to try to figure out what they really meant. Now, lots of people thought that he was the one who was corrupting history. That is to say, the jury really is out, as we all know, about what the founders really meant. As if they would have spoken with the unified voice to begin with. So Lincoln's the one who's got the real difficult argument to make that they would have wanted. I mean, he has to talk about the Northwest Ordinance. He has to talk about what they really would have meant when they talked about equality. But it's a stretch. And he's the one who's really got to make that leap of faith. Go ahead.
But he does research, historical research. Lincoln, to my knowledge, is not any more numerate than I am. I consider myself innumerate. But what he does is to look at the documents, look at the actions of the founders, those who signed the Declaration of Independence, and later the Constitution. actually just goes through and does research, okay, what did they decide about the Northwest Ordinance? What did they decide on the question of the expansion of slavery? And the answer is that the majority of those that he found who actually took a position on this opposed it, Southern as well as Northern. He said, you know, if they thought slavery was such a terrific thing and was the only fit category for people who were black people, then why did they oppose its further extension? You know, and this is the argument that he uses in the address in New York that really establishes him as the candidate that's acceptable to the Northern folks, New York folks, the Cooper Union address. Well, he just does the count. So he really does do this research. He says, you know, if they thought slavery was such a terrific thing and the only thing for black people, you know, why did they oppose its further extension? So that's one of the things that Susan is talking about when Lincoln does the research. So he has to, it is a stretch, but this is what he actually does. He sits down and he does the work and tries to make the case that way.
Now, I'm going to ask you now, could any other president who wasn't a lawyer and wasn't a Lincoln come up with this at this pivotal time in our history?
Well, I guess you could say, who's the logical alternative? It would have been Stephen Douglas, right?
Well, no. No. The logical alternatives were people who were lawyers, but who argued that there was a higher law than the Constitution, that the moral law superseded. I mean, Douglas could have, but I was...
No, I mean, who would have been president? I mean, my students and I really wrestle with this. So what if there's no Lincoln? Does Lincoln matter, right? Or would others have come to this same conclusion? So you play this counterfactual, okay, well, what if Stephen Douglas, his main rival in 1860, had won? Might he have come? Because secession was coming, right? The Southerners had no love for Stephen Douglas. He appears on very few of their ballots. In fact, the Democratic Party splits in two. It's a four-way election in 1860. So you might have seen similar hostility, similar moves by South Carolina and other states to secede that puts Douglas in a similar position. I suspect he would have been much quicker to compromise. I don't know, help me out here, then.
What about Seward or Chase? What if they had been nominated instead of Lincoln? Could they have done this?
Well, that's ironic. I mean, in some ways, their anti-slavery sentiment is fiercer and more public. The South fears them in some ways more than Lincoln. The question then becomes, could they have pulled it off?
Could they have gotten elected? Mm-hmm. And two, could they have provided the leadership?
Well, again, we're back to this question of leadership that we've talked about before. I mean, we tend to lionize Lincoln because we know how the story ends. But to say that he's a great leader at the time is is a difficult proposition to make. This is a guy who cannot keep a general or a commander, who is hated on the home front by the Democratic Party, who is seen as a tyrant and a demagogue. So leadership is a... who almost loses in 1864 in re-election. So... that raises a lot of problems, doesn't it? And also, I think we underestimate how much Lincoln compromises, right? The original 13th Amendment, right, was a constitutional amendment that Lincoln was willing to sign that would have meant that Congress and the executive branch would never interfere with slavery in the states where it already existed.
That was a draft?
That was the original 13th Amendment.
It was an unamendable amendment to the Constitution that the Republican Party endorsed and passed.
And then secession occurred.
And then secession happened and it was off the table.
But it was the length he was willing to go to. Right?
Put your jaw back where it was.
I mean, the crucial thing that we have to remember is that emancipation for him is a means to an end. The most important thing in the world to him is the Union. It's not slavery. Right, but slavery in the West is the one thing he won't compromise on. I'm sorry, Greg, have I just...
I never knew that. You know, in other words, the Republican Party was willing to sell out its very new birthright.
The birthright of the Republic was the West. It was no expansion of slavery to the West.
But
slavery. But
preserve it in the rest of the where it was.
If that's necessary.
So lack in the Constitution. So that didn't the founders in the Constitution, I mean the constitutional writers, have an end to it at some point?
Have an end?
Not to slavery.
No. No, it's not articulated. Or as Russ said, it's not even articulated.
But Lincoln articulated that they thought it would fade out.
That would be their hope.
Okay.
Right. This is a tightrope for him.
Okay, I'm done with my questions. Let's go around the table.
I thought that
anything surprise you? More questions?